The three people that are here, first person to my left is Henning von Kugelgen, who teaches at the Free University in Berlin. Next to him is David Woodward, who is at Seattle Pacific. Is that correct?
Vaguely.
He's the director for well, now I'm not going to say
Intensive English Language Institute.
Say yeah. So. And further to the left is Ron Large, who teaches at Gonzaga in Spokane, Washington. I'm going to ask David to start out by giving, he brought a shortwave radio along with him and has been listening in to the events that have been taking place in the Soviet Union. And for those, the benefit of us who have not been able to listen to the radio or know the current events, he'll give a brief setting for that and then start with Henning and go along the line for statements.
Actually, anybody who read the PI today would be up
to it.
But I guess the one thing that you get off of a shortwave radio that's really interesting is if you listen to Radio Australia or BBC, you get a bit of a different slant on the news. So I'm never quite sure if I'm only getting news from one source, if it's really the whole picture. So that's the nice thing about a shortwave radio. But of course, with the coup failing, Gorbachev, for a brief time, seemed to be back in his position, but it seems like he's been totally eclipsed by Yeltsin as head of the Russian Federation. And Yeltsin has managed to appoint all of his friends in positions of power. Now, in the first few days, I think there was a lot of euphoria, feeling of how wonderful it is that the coup failed and that now freedom and democracy will reign supreme. But the latest articles and things on the radio are indicating some concern about how Russian nationalism is on the rise. And this has been something that people have been concerned about, the rise of super patriotism in Russia, and what that could mean for minorities like Jewish people who have suffered in the past from the Russian people. So other republics are very concerned because now Yeltsin and the Russian Republic is firmly in the driver's seat in control of the military, most of the nuclear weapons. And already Yeltsin has said a few things about, well, we might want to take a look at some of the border issues between Russia and for example, Ukraine and the Crimea. And so, well, that makes everybody a little nervous. Russia is about 80% of the Soviet Union. So they have the power to get their way if they want to use force. So probably the great concern now is there going to be a Yugoslavia kind of a breakup where there's a lot of civil strife and warring between republics. And today's news was that Ukraine and Russia went right ahead and put together a de facto agreement between them, economic and military, way ahead of anything that Gorbachev has been trying to do. And so this shows that Russia is in the driver's seat and just saying, well, we're going to do bilateral agreements with various republics. And if you're lucky, you'll get in now, so to speak, I think, is the message to the republics. And, you know, just to get in line and make an agreement with us. So I think there's a lot of concern in the outlying republics about what Russia's going to do.
Okay. Thanks, David. Henning, why don't you begin?
Yeah, my situation is so that I am European, and so I understood that I should try to put a slight emphasis on what this all might mean to Europe, to Germany. Another concern of mine is also what it means to the so-called Third World, what might be also an issue tomorrow in another session. The situation is so that Germany is a little in a tricky situation now, because on one hand, I have learned that it was pretty wise to work so fast on this so-called reunification of Germany, because now, after everything seems to split up so nicely, it is very hard to negotiate, because to whom will you negotiate now? And therefore I was one of the opponents of this rush, what they have had there before. I have now to agree that it was a good step to do a quick step. What else could we learn? German people used to say in East Germany, Russia is our big brother, not our friend, because a friend you can choose. And this is actually the same situation for most of the states we have now in Russia, and so I'm pretty sure that some of them won't even join this kind of new federation or confederation or commonwealth, whatever will turn out in the very end. It also shows the German situation, even though they try to deliberate them from Russia to get trapped into West Germany, this very deep concern about your nationalistic ideas and also some kind of racism grows very nicely in this situation. And I think it is very much related to the fact that in when you see that a system, what you had to believe in and what you were taught to for 40, 50, 60, 70 years breaks apart, and these pictures what show up in the magazines and newspapers now are those when they tear down monuments of old leaders and recent leaders of the KGB, that there is a lack of some kind of ideology or idea to follow, and that very often means to look back to your traditions and to your position in this country, and that is of course a breed for any kind of civil wars and struggles and border fights and so on.
Yeah, well, I think one of the interesting things about all this is sort of the, I don't know whether it's an irony or not, but I've been reading the New York Times a little bit, one of the interesting debates going on between different factions in the administration is related to this. I mean, how fast does the U.S. move? I don't know if most of you know this, but the Baltic states have declared their independence, and they've already been recognized diplomatically by some of the countries in Europe, and I think the whole European foreign ministers, I think 12 of them, put out a statement yesterday which essentially is going to lead toward a diplomatic recognition of the Baltics. Now, the United States hasn't done that yet, and there's some debate in the administration as to whether or not they should wait and see whether the Soviet Union grants them formal status. So I think the key for the United States is sort of what role do we play in this? I mean, what should our policy be? I mean, should it be moving quickly, or should it be to shore up Gorbachev? I mean, that's been the debate all along. I mean, last year when Yeltsin came to the United States, they barely gave him the time of day. It was all, the Bush's focus was on, Gorbachev, he's the one in charge, what's the one we're going to deal with. And so that left them, I mean, they don't know where they're going now, because they're not sure really who is in power anymore. So I think that's one key concern. I mean, what should our policy be? How should we deal with the breakup? Should we try and work to, like Gorbachev, he said today if they didn't get some kind of union, he'd resign. Whether that's a pipe dream or not, I don't know. Should we facilitate that? Should we work toward that? Should our aid be based on that? Should we even give aid? A lot of talk before the coup attempt was, again, a debate, well, we should let the Soviet Union do some more, then we'll give them aid and see what they do. So there's a lot of ambiguities there. I don't think the administration has a clear handle on, what they're doing yet. And the other related issue I just want to raise quickly was, David talked a little bit about this on the military side. Do we deal with these, the republics now as independent military powers? I mean, where are the nuclear weapons? I mean, the Ukraine's got some, the bulk is in Russia, but there and other places. It'd be like, well, in the United States, they're in Washington, they're in Montana, they're in North Dakota, some in South Dakota. I mean, what would it be to say South Dakota and North Dakota declared themselves independent? I mean, who has control over those things now? So there's a lot of uncertainty there. And I think that's the key thing I want to kind of throw out to have people think about in terms of precisely that ambiguity and uncertainty, and what should we be doing about it? So.
Thanks, Ron. David?
I guess the slant I'd like to throw on it is as it relates to the Middle East, because not only that's my favorite topic, but I think in terms of if you look at the world in terms of where things are happening and what are the sort of the most critical issues worldwide, all the last 3 years of change in Europe, the Berlin Wall coming down and peace breaking out and this sort of thing, in the back of my mind, I'm sitting here thinking, yeah, but the Middle East, you know, the conflicts are still going on and peace hasn't broken out there. And, of course, this was before the Gulf War conflict. But there was this sort of, I think, a naive feeling expressed in the media that, the world is now almost virtually some kind of a utopia. Well, anybody who's looked at the third world lately knows that a lot of people are not living in a utopia. And there's tremendous poverty, there's tremendous population growth going on in the third world, and a lot of it in the Middle East. And so it isn't, in my mind, primarily a concern in terms of how it affects the U.S. To me, that's the least of the problem. The U.S. is, you know, relatively speaking, in great shape. The Western countries are in tremendous shape. But if one simply looks at the world and says, where is the suffering, where is the trouble, it's in these overpopulated countries that have, where their economic structures have fallen apart, where through years of war, too much spending on military, governments are just at a loss for direction. That's, to me, that's where the real problems are. And I think that as we learn more about the Soviet Union, we're going to see the same thing throughout the Soviet Union, just the mess that the Soviet Union is in and the tremendous human need there. So I guess that's my primary interest, is in trying to focus attention on where the greatest need is and where the greatest suffering is, and how perhaps the United States, with its incredible power at this stage in history, can focus assistance and aid other than in a military nature, and really start bringing to bear some of its tremendous technological resources and other kinds of potential for good.
Can I add one more quick thing?
Sure.
I just was thinking about this earlier, and a couple points maybe think about it again. There was an article in the Atlantic magazine, or it must have been about a year ago. I can't remember the guy's name. He teaches political science or history at the University of Chicago. And the title of the article was, "Why We Will Miss the Cold War." And his argument was that one thing the Cold War did was give some sort of stability to conflict. And what he argued, we had a bipolar relationship, where you could, instead of multipolar, which is what we have now. And he was arguing that that's much more complex, in some respects much more dangerous. So the collapse of the wall and the collapse of communism has created a lot more problems, where in fact people thought that might be better. He was arguing it might not be as good as we think it might be, and using this bipolarity as the metaphor. So I just thought that was kind of an interesting notion, so I'll throw that out too.
I'm going to move a little bit. I'm little uncomfortable. Many people sit behind me if I'm supposed to see interested in speaking. So, first hand.
A little this way.
Reading U.S. News yesterday, or U.S. News Today, the right part of it yesterday, in these countries that are leaving, or states that supposedly that are leaving Russia, they either have transplanted or there were there many Russians in these countries. So I would assume that some of these percentages are pretty high, they show. But I would assume that these countries just leaving Russia is not going to be a complete bed of roses for them. Mm-hmm. They are going to have problems within themselves with these transplanted Russians, so they're going to have to boot them out. This should have some effect on them.
Yeah, well, Yeltsin was saying something, I think they even referred to this, about any breakaway republics are going to have to deal with two things, border issues and the Russian population in them. So I don't know what that means.
Well, some percentages are pretty high, yeah. Especially in the
United States. Yeah, I mean, in fact, Latvia is over 50% ethnic Russian.
I think what Ron was talking to a little bit, I saw in the paper yesterday where in these breakaway states that have indicated that they run independence, there are over 2,000 missiles with their associated warheads. Now before we could negotiate with just Russia, who had control of all of those, but if the control of those devices are shared or are divided up amongst all these other people, it's going to be quite
I mean, you got to negotiate with the people with the guns. Mm-hmm. If Gorbachev doesn't control any of this anymore, he becomes pointless. I mean, so what does a strategic arms reduction treaty mean? You know, I mean, I'm sort of torn in some respects. I mean, I think everybody's, what has happened is what at least U.S. foreign policy has wanted to happen for, 50 years, really, or longer. But yet, now it's here, it's like, what do we do? What do we do with it? And I just don't see any coherence coming out of it yet. Maybe that's just too early. I'm not overly critical about it. Just that there's a lot of questions I don't think have been answered.
Do these countries have organized governments? It seems like Yeltsin has pretty well got the Russian state in control, but you don't hear anything of leaders of any significance.
I'd like to toss out on that area, a little perspective on some of the Muslim republics in the Soviet Union. About almost half of the Soviet Union's population is Muslim. Now, while Russia is 80% of the Soviet Union, they're not all Russians. And so within the Russian Republic are a great many Muslim people, and most of them are Turkic-speaking people. So if half of the Soviet Union is Muslim, then that has a lot to do with the future of those republics. And in effect, in those republics, primarily in the southern band of the Soviet Union, they have a kind of organizational structure there based around traditional kind of structures within their society. Within the village, it would be the head person, and within the region, there would be a strong man, usually. In some cases, it's almost like a mafia type of structure, where you have to pay for protection money, and there's a lot of illegal bartering going on and that sort of thing. So there is a kind of organization to those societies. The political organization was primarily run by the Communist Party. So now that it's disbanded, the question is who will fill those posts. But they do have their own regional governments.
And
I can ask a question, kind of going back to the who's got the bombs and you have to negotiate with them. My understanding of the Russian military is, or the Soviet Union's military, is that it's top-heavy in the sense that the field commanders really don't have any authority and don't do anything. They do what they're told. That all direction comes from the top. And secondly, that it's heavily Russian at the top.
Yeah,
and
of course.
So that, at least in some sort of theory, the breakaway states might have some military, but what they're going to have is a whole bunch of local units without any power. So and conceptually, you know, the state of Washington's got nukes and Bangor and I suppose in Fairchild and a few other places, but if the state of Washington succeeded tomorrow, I have no belief that we could, would, or have any way to use it. I'm kind of have the same analogy.
I think that's probably true in terms of the overall military structure. I think one of the things that I was reading about the coup was that apparently, now again it's speculation, but apparently when the people that were plotting the coup also had Gorbachev's nuclear codes. That's the key. Who's got the codes? The way they're launched, they're, at least in the United States anyway, there's two sets of codes that have to come in, and then the keys are turned, and that sets it off. And I'm assuming that there's some, safeguards there. But I was really surprised to learn that, and at least that's what the Times was, saying. So, I think that's the kind of thing that people are worried about. It's not so much whether the junior officers are going to do what they're told or not do what they're told, but more in terms of how the control and command structure is going to be organized when there's so much disaffection or lack of continuity within that structure. So that's the issue that I would be concerned about. But I think, in terms of overall structure, I think that's true.
One comment in the paper that was kind of humorous was, well, yeah, there is that threat and concern that, say, some renegade would get a hold of the capability. But on the other hand, if these people can't even control the Baltics or, some other regional problem, why would they want to get into a war with the United States? It's like they aren't, on the whole, people in political positions are not suicidal. Even Saddam Hussein, as much as he was referred to as a crazy man, in the last analysis, is not a technically speaking, a crazy man. He's still in power. He still has control over his own operation. So as much as he was considered a crazy person, he's not suicidal. And very, very few people in leadership are suicidal. And so while we do need to be concerned about that, I think that in some ways within a few months we're going to feel that the nuclear issue needs to be dealt with in a global way.
Right.
That it's not primarily an issue of what is the Soviet Union going to do with its nuclear weapons, but we now have a situation where, in a sense, 20 or 25 different independent countries have significant nuclear weapons. What does the future hold? Can every time somebody gets a hold of nuclear weapons, like in Iraq, or begins to, can we go in and pound them into the ground? I don't think that's going to be viable in the future. So we're going to have to start with a whole new approach to incorporate all of these countries who have the potential to have nuclear power, nuclear weapons, and to develop some kind of a consensus that where everybody agrees there's absolutely no point in using them or having them even, because if you do, it's suicidal. And so let's start building down. But we have to deal with these various republics in a peer approach rather than, we say you've got to do this. And there's got to be more of a sense of a working, perhaps through the United Nations.
I read in the Christian Science Monitor that there at least was some concern, not so much that the nuke, that the codes got into wrong hands per se. That wasn't a great fear for the United States, because the likelihood is if it got used, they were going to get used on each other.
Yeah.
That literally it was going to get used within the Soviet Union on other breakaway republics, etc. That was much more likely than you know, they're not going to lob one over here because they've got so many problems at home. They're going to lob one at each other.
Mm-hmm. Well, it depends on the ranges, too. But I think the other thing, too, is that one of the things that the republics are trying to deal with, I read a comment, I think it was by one of the leaders of one republic talking about Yeltsin and Russia, saying, well, their attitude seems to be like, we're first among equals, which is obviously a contradiction. And I think it is much more of an internal, you know, struggle. And I don't see the United States yet sure of where it's going with that. Has anybody heard anything lately on what's going on with the U.S. recognition of the Baltics? Has anybody?
It'll probably
anybody
come
that came
tomorrow.
Up. They're going to do it.
Well, it sounds likely that tomorrow.
The CIOPI we had today, they made no comment to that specific area.
Okay.
Yeah, yesterday it said Friday though.
Yeah.
I have a comment.
Yeah, go ahead.
I'd like to ask the panel what they think about the chances of the U.S. actually getting a peace dividend this time. We talked about it a lot a year ago, and then we found a way to not get that in the Middle East crisis. Can the military defense complex action, the Defense Department and the administration actually prevent us from getting a peace dividend this time?
Well, there was an interesting editorial, I guess, last week by Pat Buchanan. And Buchanan was arguing we ought to go keep on going with Star Wars and SDI and everything else. So,
what about NATO? Maybe I could ask any about the NATO. Do we really need NATO anymore? That's a huge drain on our budget. We spend $100 billion every year on our part of NATO.
Well, yeah, the situation now looks different, yet they confirmed all the time, at least European countries confirmed the relationship to the USI via the NATO. And one of the reasons is, of course, that now when Germany becomes more powerful and Europe is soon going to be very strong as a whole, as some kind of unified power, they don't want to, you know, break a fence or something. And I think that the NATO continues working is very much related to that fact. You know, they just don't want to break off old pacts and traditions. And the very, very recent movements in the Soviet Union might bring up this discussion, but I know only that what I can read in the recent American papers. So.
My son's in Germany, stationed in a NATO unit there, and what's happened recently, of course, as I understand it, there's still Russian soldiers in what used to be Eastern Germany, quite a few of them there, but in the meantime, There are two corps in Germany itself, corps consisting of divisions. The divisions have been, two armored divisions have been deactivated. One was sent to Iraq and then back to the United States from Iraq. Another one's just disappeared, doesn't exist any longer. And the army units that are in Germany have all been reduced by 10%. And as guys rotate out, they're consolidating the unit. A lot of the caserns or small bases that are being closed almost daily. So it's not going to be an immediate withdrawal, but in a period of 2 or 3 years, we'll probably still have an Air Force presence there, Rhein-Main and Castle Guard and some of the bases. But
I'm not so sure about that.
I'm not either.
I mean, the difference is what one is kind of negotiations and pacts and, you know, and agreements. The other thing is the presence, and so therefore the U.S. Air Force is present in Great Britain and in other places in Europe. They don't necessarily have to stay in Germany.
Exactly.
Therefore, as you might know, Germany is the only country at the moment who does somehow tries its own way, because they have this very special situation that they have this very many Russian army people still living, and they somehow want to buy them out. You know, I mean, they, of course, nobody would say that, but that's actually what they try to do, and that's why Germany is now not just the biggest donator, but the only one who said we won't freeze our aids now, and in order to support Mikhail Gorbachev, who is actually the person who made things possible, and who is, as we already found out, easier to negotiate with than with, let's say, 15 different states, you know, about people being sent home and so on.
So would the trade-off then be the Russian soldiers out of Germany and then the U.S. out? I mean, is that the...
I'm pretty sure that would be happening, yeah. Because, I mean, French and British armies, I mean, that's all related to the situation after the Second World War. And now things have changed entirely, and Germany is recognized now as a so-called reunified country. And therefore, I mean, at the beginning it was, of course, in order to fight fascism and to make sure that there will be no other Hitler rising in Germany. But later on it was, as you pointed out there, more related to, you know, have this battlefield, Germany, you know, east and west, very close to each other, the wall, the Iron Curtain, not just a symbol, but also, of course, a very, very experienceable situation. And therefore I think that it will work out like that, that it would be strong at all.
I'd like to hear some addressing of economic impact problem. And I guess the final of it is the disintegration of the economic system in Russia continues. What will Germany do, or France, or Italy, when they have 20 million Russian people of various nationalities wanting to work for half the wages?
Well, they already, I mean, there are already quite a few of agreements and contracts between those two countries, or the former Soviet Union and Germany, in order to, you know, build ships. Many of those contracts have been from those days of the GDR, and they were somehow, you know, exposed to nowadays. And there are very many kind of joint ventures going on. I think this situation now will, of course, change a lot, because at least now for a while it will be pretty insecure whether you should invest and what way you would invest. But at the very moment, you know, workers in East Germany get only 60% of the wages. So, I mean, there's enough work to be done. And we have Czechoslovakia and Polish people. What are much closer and maybe still cheaper. I mean, if you look in this way, there's a very big...
Get, you know, the most immediate, you know, the stock market drops because we have to, and then it didn't quite take, and then the stock market goes up. So there's must be real world implications on the economic side from the disintegration of the economic system in Russia.
I think on the positive side, that if you know, money that was going to support a very large military is no longer, in other words, people aren't being taxed for that purpose. I consider military, while it produces some jobs, in the end result is a drain on any country's economy. And I think that's why Germany and Japan have done so well. I mean, I think that's fairly well accepted that, say, Japan isn't carrying its fair shake, so to speak, you know, and is doing well economically as a result. So if the Soviet Union is now going to be reducing the amount of money, now, that's a big if, because if tensions rise and, you know, the various republics feel that they have to start arming themselves, and there you end up with an arms war between various Soviet republics, then the people are going to end up suffering even more. But if they can develop some kind of a treaty where it isn't necessary for them to arm against one another, then presumably they will have a peace dividend because of the reduction of money going to a central military system. As far as the comment about U.S. peace dividend, I don't think we'll see it, for the very simple fact that, you know, we're in debt up to our eyeballs. So any money that we can recover, presumably, will have to go to cover the massive debt that we have. There was just one other sort of side note. Yesterday's paper, I think, mentioned a treaty in the Philippines to continue Subic Bay for another 10 years. I don't really see that as being primarily for military purposes, though. I think it's a way to kind of placate the Filipino people and maintain them as a friend and ally, because they need our military spending in the Philippines to keep their own economy afloat. But I think, yeah, in the long run, there will be a grand reduction of, you know, U.S. military expenditure, too.
Well, watching, just reading about Yeltsin and how much he's calling a lot of the shots, do you know anything about, is he calling for as much unity as Gorbachev? Gorbachev says, there's not unity, I'm going to resign. He's not?
I don't think so.
So assuming he would continue to call the shots, there may not might not be all this conflict between the republics, because they will be able to go away from the union if they choose to.
Well, I think, well, again, it's not clear what's going on. Maybe this relates to kind of the economic question as well, because I the stock market thing was kind of funny, because I'm not saying I agree with this, but let me throw out this scenario as one way to read what happened. The coup comes, the stock market crashes. Why? Not so much because it's an ideological thing about democracy and totalitarianism, but they're going to close their doors to Western investment. Okay? So there's not going to be that opportunity to make money, so the market goes down. So the coup fails. Well, we'll be back to Gorbachev again. It opens up, and now, you know, the stock market rises again. So it's not, so I mean, one thing capitalists like and business people like is a stable environment. And I would argue that if the Soviet Union begins to fracture, like say Yugoslavia, you're not going to get anybody investing in an environment like that, where there's a total uncertainty, total chaos. It's just not going to happen. So it's more just from that. I mean, so that might be one way to look at the stock market, which is crazy enough as it is. I mean, much less trying to figure it out in real terms.
Well, an adjunct to that is that the Russian Republic is going to do, as any nation does, what's in its best interests. So it is in their best interest to have good economic ties with all of the other republics. I mean, they already have a lot of interdependence. Ukraine produces a tremendous amount of coal, for example, and the southern republics produce a tremendous amount of food. And so Russia, which has the largest land, also has the lousiest.
Why isn't Yeltsin calling for unity?
Well, his first priority is to establish his power base. In other words, he isn't concerned about this ideal of a Soviet Union sort of federation. That's Gorbachev's thing. Yeltsin's primary responsibility is to satisfy his supporters, who are Russian people. So, number one, he's got to demonstrate that he's in control of Russia, the Russian Federation, and that he's going to do whatever's in their best interests, just as our politicians say we're going to do what's in our best interests as a nation. So he isn't responsible for the Soviet Union, although he indeed may end up more or less running it, or at least the leader in the Soviet Union. So he's just doing what any normal political leader would do.
Yeah, I was just wondering, you mentioned stock market crash. What happened there? I wasn't aware of that.
Well, Monday when it was the coup came, it dropped 100 points, I think, in the first 2 hours, and it ended up, what, 80 60, down 60, or something like that?
And you lost your life savings, right?
Yeah, right. Yes.
Price of wheat went down 50%.
And then when the coup failed, it recovered most. I don't know where it sits now. Is anybody...
It's up
beyond what it was
past Monday?
High. It's
better. It
may
be recognized.
Yeah, so... You know, I think they see it, you know, the stock market is maybe even more political than it is economic in some respects, in response to political pressures and realities, too, and it's got its own ideology, you know, so I think the key for the United States and there was also this debate with the administration. This is kind of, I mean, there's always on... There seems to be kind of two factions at work here, and I think the way that the newspapers have played that out, it's kind of Brent Scowcroft on one hand and Dick Cheney on the other. One of them wants to go one way and one wants to go the other way. So, I mean, that's the kind of tension they're dealing with. There isn't a unified policy in the administration. And whether or not the argument was, well, now we should give them aid. Bush had been sitting and holding back on that for a long time. Well, let's wait and see what they do. They haven't really gone this far yet. They need to do a little bit more. And, you know, of course, the great hypocrisy is what he was, you know, the Chinese didn't have to do anything. He was going to give them, you know, most favored nation status. But, and now the argument is, well, this has changed. This is different. We got to give them the aid now. And other people say, no, we got to. So they're not at one voice on this. And they just, so I think that's the key. And they don't know what they're doing yet. I mean, I don't mean that as an overt criticism. It is somewhat, but. Maybe they're, you know, sitting. It's like we're saying, do we go fast or do we go slow?
There are lots of. I want to get people a chance who haven't spoken. So.
I had my congregation in Portland has sponsored a number of Russian Pentecostal refugees who have come to the United States under the guise of religious discrimination in the Soviet Union. With these recent changes, will that kind of oppression be eliminated or minimized with maybe the demise of the Communist Party? I don't have an answer to
it.
Just a question.
Well, I know it's more, I mean, the churches are more open now than they have. I mean, they're even having services and things like that.
Well, not only that, under Gorbachev recently, the national television was putting on religious broadcasts, national radio putting on religious broadcasts provided by Western sources. Bibles are being distributed all over the place. It's a pretty open situation. I think it's a totally different situation now. Fairly positive from that standpoint. Well, the biggest problem the Russian church, Soviet church has is the Western tourists that come over and need to be chauffeured around. That's from what I'm serious. I mean, it's a drain on them, apparently. All these people that want to get in on the action, you know, and come over and pose for the cameras and then you know, they don't need that. They just, you know, need people who will fellowship with them and treat them as peers and develop a kind of a sense of a peer, you know, relationship.
I think one of the major problems they're going to have to deal with now, when there was a Soviet government, there was control over distribution of the personal needs of the people, too. This is no longer present. The will is going to be one of the major chaos in the period. It's a lack of of control of the distribution of the food supply.
Yeah, I mean,
if I'm hungry, I'm going to eat myself right. Somewhere.
But on the other hand, I mean, that was the whole problem, was what a lousy centralized system they had. And so, yes, they have to scrap it in order to get a head start. But I don't think anybody's sorry to see the old system go because it was so inefficient.
But there's nothing in place. Yeah.
Right.
To replace that, because it's going to take time.
Well, it's the black market, the free market, yeah. But, you know, in the old system, one example was they had four-digit phone numbers for the people on the inside. And those people could just call up and get whatever they wanted. And this was famous throughout the Soviet Union, that the four-digit number. And that there was this sort of inner circle who could get anything they wanted, and the rest just suffered. So, you know, that needs to be done away with. And it's like, yeah, you have to go through pain in order to end up ahead. And I think they're on the right track in that regard.
Um, And some other comment in relation to the economics of no tourism, just read some reliable statistics that really astounded me. And that is that the United States, during the Cold War with Russia, with the USSR, the United States spent $4.4 trillion, that's 4,000 billion, during the Cold War, and the USSR spent $4.3 trillion during that. If you want to really be impressed how much money they go down and go home tonight and write that out on a few pages of the old bill, and what the horrible economic impact must be. And that's why I think, you know, maybe they're older people because they can stop spending some of their money now. But it really puts them in a poor economic position than they ever have in the United States. A lot of money.
I'd like to ask people in the audience a question in terms of questions have been directed to us. I'm kind of curious to know how everybody feels about the Soviet Union and Russia. Is this a place you'd want to visit? Are you optimistic? What are people thinking? Is this our new ally?
Ally against who?
I don't know. I'm sort of.
Well, one thing that strikes me is Russia decreases their military stance in the world, is that the president outlines a group of bases or camps or whatever in the military that they want to close. And then our stupid senators, they fight every one of them to keep the base open. And how are we, and then they talk about they want to decrease the spending in the country and lower the national debt. Any one of us could sit down there in Congress and come up with better solutions than what they're doing. They fight to keep all these places open just so that they can keep an economic base, so to speak. But with all the moxie we got, we ought to be able to create something else in a military giant to satisfy our economic condition.
This is representative democracy that the Russians now want more of.
I would be hesitant to visit Russia at this time because of the uncertainty of the political situation. I would think you would possibly just be looking for trouble. And I worry about this because I've got a granddaughter who is interested in doing this, and she may be working for a company that is interested in trade with Russia. And she's a Russian major as far as language goes, and that's why she's in this position. I'd be extremely concerned if she went to that.
One thing that kind of bothers me is how are these countries going to get along with each other? I'm kind of curious as what their history was before World War II. Were they able to get along before they were incorporated into the Soviet Union? I think there was a lot of conflict there. And are we going to go back to that kind of thing? And if so, is that a step back? It's a good possibility, an immediate step backward, at least for a while.
I guess it's always the point is where does the third party step in to break up the fight? And it's really a hard, and if the fight doesn't take place, it never gets over with. So all the internal, I feel that the internal problems from the religious and the is really, I really feel that it's very difficult for them to overcome it without a long period of time. And that is very pessimistic. And I really feel hurt for the fact that the basic people suffer from it. And you can't pick yourself up by the bootstraps. But I have always felt the government, in fact, have been the enemy in both sides. The government of the United States and the government of Russia has, in fact, been the enemy. And I've never felt the Russian people by itself have that antagonism. I get this from reading whether it's true or not.
I'd like to bring up a question related to that David and Ron both spoke about. Your condemnation, basically, of either one of those governments. What is the U.S. role? I mean, what's our position going to be? What would you want the U.S. to do? What are you going to advocate for? Or are you not going to advocate at all? Because we're at a point, obviously, another watershed again in history. And where do we go from here? What's our role? What's our responsibility?
My response to that would be kind of a follow-up to the other question I asked. Historically, at least, you know, those that have get more and those that don't get less. And my perception is what may very likely come out of this whole process for that country and for Europe both is that we're going to see more ethnic splitting, more separation and disaffection. And my gut reaction is if that happens, that those countries or those republics or whatever that look more European and look more white and look more Western are going to come out ahead, be that the Russia, the Baltics, and some of those. And those that may be Islamic or those that may be the other ethnic are going to end up looking more like third world countries and in a very distinct way. And I guess the answer to that is you know, my personal belief is that our response to South America and our response to Africa has to be the same response that you take to the Soviet Union, is that third world countries need to be dealt with and third world countries need to be supported. And, you know, to look at it, I just have this sinking feeling that those that have are going to end up on top of this and going to have more. And those that have little are going to have a lot less when it's done. And, you know, the third world just gained some more nations. And all. That's my gut reaction.
Anybody else?
Do we see the possibility of any Islamic governments being formed of a clerical nature such as they have in Iran?
In the southern Soviet Union?
In the southern part of the Soviet Union.
You know, the Iranian government isn't really being, nobody's modeling on the Iranian model now. I mean, in the Muslim world. Khomeini, number one, he was ruling a nation that was Shia. Most of the Muslim world is Sunni. And so the Sunni people tend to feel that the Shia are a little bit more emotional and a little more extreme. I think that's a stereotype I don't necessarily agree with. But they don't necessarily want to model on Khomeini. And in fact, within Iran today, you see them moving away from that kind of a radical appearance. I say appearance because the reality on the ground was that they simply were incompetent. Political leaders. They didn't really do a whole lot. They just kind of used the war with Iraq to keep the country together and to consolidate their power. But I think, yeah, there will be some Muslim, sort of technically there will be Islamic governments in the southern Soviet Union. That doesn't necessarily mean it's bad. It's just sort of an acknowledgement of the kind of local law that they'll have, which will be based on Islam rather than a secular law. But it doesn't necessarily have any implications, good or bad, as far as how the U.S. would relate to them. I mean, we have now some allies, so to speak, I use the word intentionally, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, now are considered the good guys because they worked with us in the Gulf conflict. But
well, Khomeini's power really came from the kind of a despicable condition that a lot of people have due to the Shah.
That's right, anti-Shah feeling. That's really what it boiled down to. But here's a great example of this. I had an Iranian guy that was in my class as an English student, and I brought him in to talk to some American students about Iran. And he said, yeah, I was marching in 79 in Tehran in some of these demonstrations. He said, nobody really knew who Khomeini was until the Voice of America explained who he was to us. And I mean, he was not a well-known political figure, but he became someone they could rally around.
But the point was, there was just a tremendous amount of hatred, not just for the Shah, but his secret police. There was estimates of 1 in 10 Iranians were in some way connected with the secret police. And anybody who had any criticism was taken away, and tremendous, you know, persecution of intellectuals.
Bad food circulation, there is in some of these countries fear of sufficient nature to form, to let a radical form of government form with the idea of satisfying their problems, such as they try to satisfy with the Shah's problem.
That's a good question. I think in Egypt, yeah, if the government tries to increase, you know, they have government subsidized food prices in a lot of third world countries, and if the government increases food prices too rapidly, as has happened in places like Poland, then the riots start. And so, yeah, the economic problem is the number one issue now.
Yeah. Our time is nearly up. We'll take one more question.
I'm wondering if there's been any reaction from China to all this, since they are neutered, and should be well affected soon. Have you
had anything? I haven't seen anything. There was a brief article, I think it was in today's or yesterday's New York Times, about China, but it was only like 2 columns, very short. And it was, I think, only just that they were just being cautious. And my sense that, you know, it's kind of interesting, because we've always played the Chinese against the Soviets and the Soviets against the Chinese, and we've done that for a long time.
The Chinese came out in favor of the coup.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Right off the bat. Mm-hmm. They were extremely enthusiastic mm-hmm. about this.
Okay.
And then the door was kind of slammed in their face.
But they're kind of the odd country out, you know, on this. I think the interesting thing would be not so much what the Soviet relationship with the Chinese would be, but how this might affect our relationship.
I think some reaction when the coup started was that it was going to be him, and they're all over going to mow him down.
Yeah. Well, there was some, Yeltsin was saying that there's this elite that, like, the United States has the Delta Force.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the KGB's got this thing called Group Alpha. And they apparently refused to storm Yeltsin's, you know, they call it the White House.
Yeah.
You know, refused to storm. And that was one of the major factors in not getting enough force in place in time to prevent the people from getting there. So,
one of the big debates about this is, like, how could it have failed? I mean, if you read Lenin's specific on what to do when you stage a coup.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like a 7-step process. It's very straightforward and it's very clear cut. You know, and the big sort of unknown in this was, how could these guys have been so dumb? But of course, then the counter argument is, well, they didn't understand the people, and maybe that's, you know, maybe one quick final word, maybe that's the most positive outcome on this. I mean, fascism or any form of totalitarianism has never trusted its own people. Never. The people are always the enemy. You got to control them. That's why secret police are necessary. And that's the key. And maybe that's the most positive outcome of this in terms of the breakup of that kind of perspective.
I would like to add, my last word would be that in terms of the question raised about the U.S. role, that I sense here at Holden and probably throughout the United States, there's a reluctance to sort of trumpet ourselves as the great world leader. But from the third world perspective, all eyes are on the U.S. There's no question about it. I mean, we are the de facto world leader in so many different ways, in technology, in language, military, political influence, you name it. And the U.S. has tremendous power. So I think that means that as citizens of this country, we have got to start taking charge of the government that we have. We cannot allow a small minority of the population to elect the same old leaders and just let the same old inertia continue. That we have to come to grips with the fact that it is different from what it was 5 years ago, the world is. And we've got to address some of these issues of military spending and waste and corruption. in our own government. We have tremendous amount of corruption in this government, and we need to deal with it. And I think that's where we need to take leadership, is to show that a democracy doesn't have to end up, you know, wasting its privilege.
Thank you all for your participation, and good night.